Hi, my name's June, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, June.
Hi. So give me something to play with. Thank you, Diz. And, you know, we have developed a friendship, and, you know, I think it was Debbie that was talking this morning about how sometimes you meet somebody in AA and Al-Anon, and then you just develop a friendship in about 15 minutes, and it's a deeper friendship sometimes than people you've known a lot longer, maybe even in your own family. And we've shared a lot of good stories. Diz was very kind to me and my daughters at that that Florida State Conference, and that was one of the hardest weekends for me ever in the years that I was sober to show up for. And so it just meant a lot to me that, that he was there that weekend, Lee was there that weekend, and Lee and I have shared a lot of stories along this road also. And it's really neat to have friends that come along, you know. And it's very special for me tonight to be here. It's very special to have Beryl be the long-term member. He knew me when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how odd would that be, you know, that I'd be traveled across the country and there'd actually be someone here who knew me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. To keep with your tradition, my sobriety date is July 13th, 1972. I do want to thank Diz and the committee for inviting me so many times and for allowing me to be a part of your conference. I really want to thank whoever made my basket. It was a really lovely basket, and I really appreciate all the little goodies and stuff. I was having fun taking stuff out and looking at what was in there. It was nice, and I liked those Pringles last night. I was hungry, so. And those Snickers bars are still waiting, so I'm happy. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It has given me a life I never would have wanted, and it has made me a person I wouldn't have even liked when I came here. And I am, you know, Diz was talking about being amazed. It talks about in the book that we will be amazed before we are halfway through. I don't know where the halfway point is, if I've passed it or not, but I'm going to tell you, I'm absolutely amazed with the life that I have been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I so enjoyed all the people that shared, you know, the people that shared from the podium while we were here and the people who came up and shared little stories with me and a little bit of time as we walked around, you know, the conference this weekend. I think the conferences are magical. For those of you who are new or relatively new, I want to welcome you. And I want to start out by saying the most important things that I ever say anytime I'm asked to share, because in case you're anything like me, I've always had a relatively short attention span. I certainly did when I was new. I can still have one now. So in case you're anything like that, I start out by saying the very most important thing so then you don't have to try and listen for as long. So, let's see. Most important thing is that I am not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous, on alcoholism, or on anything else that I'll be standing up here talking about. I'm just a member. I'm going to stand up here and share a little bit like it suggests that we do in the book, what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. That's first and foremost. Another thing is that, you know, a lot of people come into Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different ways. You know, things have changed over the years that I've been sober, and people come in different ways, and I don't really think it matters how anybody gets to Alcoholics Anonymous. However, I do know that sometimes it gets a little complicated, and I want to be really clear about one thing. Alcoholics Anonymous itself is absolutely free. Had it not been free, I never could have come here. Had it not remained free, I never could have stayed. I was over 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before I could ever put a dollar in the basket, and I wasn't able to do it on a regular basis even after 10 years sober, so this is not about money, you know. And another reason I want to make sure that you know that, you know, is that, you know, after the meeting, you know, I'm just a member. I'm going to stand up here and share, and no one gets paid for doing that in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is all for fun and for free. And I want you to know that for a couple of reasons, mainly because I want you to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely free and that nothing that we do here has any price tag on it. We can't be paid. You know, we got to keep giving it away or we can't keep it. You know, and that's just the way it works here. But also because if you're sitting around in the hospitality room later, I don't want you to have to sit around saying, we had to pay her for that, so we don't have to worry about that talk, all right? Now, my very favorite thing, I think, I'll probably say that 300 times tonight while I'm up here, but really, I think my very favorite thing that anybody ever has said to me after I talked at a meeting, and believe me, people say a lot of different things, don't they? But anyway, my very favorite thing that anybody has ever said was I talked at a meeting back home, and this man came up to me afterwards, mainly because his sponsor was standing behind him and told him to, I believe, and he said, I want to thank you for your talk tonight. He said, I thought that was a good talk. He said, I don't really believe it was your talk, but I like the way you told it. And that's my favorite thing. Because I remember sitting in meetings, in the early months of my sobriety, thinking, that they were making stuff up to try and trick the newcomers into coming back, thinking that's probably not real, and I knew that that's kind of where he was coming from. But the main reason that that is my favorite thing is that this man, after hearing me share in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, actually doubted that I came from where I came from, that I lived the way that I used to live, that I felt the way that I used to feel. And I'll tell you what a tribute to Alcoholics Anonymous that someone could doubt where I came from because of what you have given me. Because what I want to assure you is when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1972, I looked exactly like my story. And I looked like my story for a hell of a long time after I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has not been a quick and easy ride for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I don't think it makes any sense to even tell you anything about it without telling you, as it suggests in the book, I just really believe in that, what it used to be like. Excuse me. I am a person who believes that I was born an alcoholic. I don't want to have a philosophical discussion with any of you about that after the meeting. It is what I believe. I believe it because there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And my first obsession in life was not alcohol, and it wasn't the chemicals that I was to mix with it. My first obsession in life was suicide. From the age of 5 years old, which is as far back as I can remember, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not believe that there was a day that went by that I did not try and take my own life, put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or pray to a God that I was slowly losing faith in to please let me die. Now, I can look back in that, in the inventory process in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can tell you that some of my suicide attempts were to try and get a little bit of attention. There's no question about that. But by and large, on a day-to-day basis, I look back, and I got to tell you, honest to God, I wanted to die. I wanted out. Life always hurt too much for me. Always. There wasn't a single thing that you could tell me to look forward to. I didn't believe any of it. I didn't want to grow up and have a relationship. I didn't want a career. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to, live in a house. I knew none of that was part of my journey. I knew that, And I just did not want, I didn't want to play at all. I wanted out. I grew up in an alcoholic home. Excuse me. I grew up with a lot of violence, a lot of different kinds of abuse that go on in a lot of alcoholic homes, and I grew up with a lot of broken promises, all the things that go on in a lot of alcoholic homes. And as I was a little kid, I looked around and I saw men and women. I'm an only child, and I noticed that the men and the women in my life who I know now today were mainly alcoholics. That's who was really in my world. That they handled the exact same situations in life, but in very different ways. Before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I never saw a man cry under any circumstances. I've seen men shot. I've seen them stabbed. I've seen them arrested. I've seen their wives leave them. I've seen their kids overdose. I've seen a lot of things happen in life. I never saw a man shed a tear, and I thought that meant that men never felt pain. I saw the women in my life go through all of those same experiences, and some of them were very tough. But I saw all of them have a breaking point. One or another of those circumstances seemed to cause them enough pain that they cried. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my whole life before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of the years after I got here trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing with the exception of anger and rage, and that's how I tried to live my life. I had a problem, though. It was a very serious problem, having set that goal for myself, which was that I'm one of those people that seem to have been born without any emotional insulation whatsoever, so that absolute strangers could look at me funny and it hurt my feelings, And when I went into the world at school at 5 years old and they started to tease me about being tall and skinny and having this hair, it felt like I was being cut inside by a knife, and these were people I didn't even care about. And so I found out about myself from the earliest age that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world, and I never forgave myself for it until long after I worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, I found out that I was weak. And that was something that I never tolerated in anyone, and most of all in myself. And I never got over that. Fortunately for me, I was lucky enough to be born with the disease of alcoholism, because alcohol worked for me. I began to use drugs on a regular basis when I was 7 years old. By the time I was 8, I was drinking on a regular basis, and it was magic. It absolutely worked, you know. And by the time I was 9, I found a combination that I never altered in any way, and that combination was barbiturates or downers or, you know, sleeping pills, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. I very rarely used one without the other once I found that combination because it worked perfectly for me. I've never had a social drink in my life. I never wanted one. I've never been a party girl, you know. I pretty much have never not overdosed, you know. I don't think I've ever not been drunk. I just didn't know that there was any point to it other than that, you know. I was not like so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why when we talk about, you know, we are people who normally would not mix, and I encourage you, if you're new, to go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we all get here in so many different ways. But I was not someone who went out there and drank so that I could feel good and so that I could have a good time. You know, that was just not my story. I drank so I didn't have to feel anything at all, and I thank God it worked for me, because I'm telling you right now, I would have had to have been locked up in some kind of an institution. I could not live with the amount of pain that was going on in my world unless alcohol had worked the way that it did for me. So I will be forever grateful that alcohol did work that way. In growing up, when I was a little kid, they said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I said, "A boy." And it wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And, you know, my family may have thought that was cute once or twice when I said that, but they began to be worried. And then I had these other things going on with my, you know, cutting my wrists and burning my body and beating myself with a hammer and these other little issues. So they began to take me to a priest for counseling. And that didn't seem to do enough, and so they found out from the priest that because we were on welfare, they could begin to take me to psychologists and psychiatrists and professionals to get some help. And so they began to take me to some of these people. I saw some of them, certainly not as members, not as many as lots of other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I saw some. Now, I don't have any kind of diagnosis to give you about what these professional people thought was really wrong with me, because I felt about those people just like my friend back home, Patty Hicks, always did. I thought those people should have to work for their money. And I never answered one question. I never filled out one form. I never played with one doll. I sat there the required 50 minutes, and when we were done, I looked him in the eye, I got up, and I walked out. I had nothing to say to these people, and obviously they weren't able to reach me in any way to give me help. I sort of figured out my own first lesson in acceptance, and that was to realize I wasn't going to be able to be a boy, and the only option that I saw as I looked at the world, the only alternative for someone like me was to be a tough broad. And that's what I spent all my time doing before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the years that I've been sober, I've traveled quite a bit, you know, in different parts of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found that there are a lot of geographical things that go with being a tough broad. It kind of depends on where you're from. I'm from a town called Venice Beach. It's out in Los Angeles, and tough broads in Venice Beach have tough feet. It goes together. You know, you never wear shoes. you have to have the ability to walk down an alley with glass and not cut your feet, and this is very important, and I could do that. I would stand down there with my gang looking at people who would be staring at us, and I would take my cigarette and I would throw it down on the sidewalk and I would put it out with my bare feet. And I'd watch those touristy looking people, and they'd whisper back and forth to one another. I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, that is one tough broad." And I was very impressed that I could do these things. After I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me that, you know, maybe what some of those people were saying to one another was, "Did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid?" But I didn't know there was another way of looking at it, you know. And anyway, I was in a gang. It was important if you were going to be a tough broad in Venice that you be in a gang. It was important that you do a lot of fighting, and I did a lot of fighting. It's important I always remember to mention that I have never won a fight in my life. However, I have never fought less than 5 people at a time. And again, after I'd been sober for a while, my sponsor explained to me, you know, if you fight one person and you lose, some people might think you're not a very good fighter. If you always fight groups of 5 or more, no one expects you to win. And some people sort of think, how come that many people had to take her on? So you can kind of almost get a reputation for being tough. And that's kind of the way it was. You know, I found out for me, having been born without this emotional insulation, that I was the kind of a person out there that I would much rather you punch me in the face than hurt my feelings. And I want to assure you that I became very good at getting people to punch me in the face. You know, it was just kind of the way that I lived my life. I found my mother, actually, I want to talk about this a little bit. You know, I grew up in this alcoholic home, and my mother had left my father. He was also an alcoholic, and a violent alcoholic who died alone in a hotel room. My grandfather in Ireland, his father had died at 46 years old in a car accident, drunk driving, and he and all of the people in the car and the other car were killed. There's been alcoholism just gone on and on in my family, you know. And my mom, when my mom and dad were born, I was talking about this at the earlier meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous did not even exist. You know, and what's kind of interesting is that my mom began to come to Alcoholics Anonymous 43 years ago, and my mom is sober tonight 3 years. She has been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous during those 43 years, and she's had varying lengths of sobriety. What I want to tell you that I learned from my mom, which was just a profound lesson, you know, is that it talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will hear people say that this is a disease that progresses even if you don't drink. Now, I know me. I just know me. I don't know you, but I know me. And I know that if I had come in and I had not lived with my mother and her alcoholism, I would not have believed that. It just doesn't make any sense, it seems to me. You don't drink, you eat better, you get a little sleep, you exercise. How could it possibly be? You know, I mean, I understand maybe you're still alcoholic. I mean, I'm not going to argue maybe with that point. But it can't progress and be worse when you go back out there. I mean, how could that be? It just doesn't seem logical. And, you know, I want to tell you a story about what happened one night in my family with my mom. My mom had been sober about a year, maybe two. I'm not sure at one point. And she came home one night and she was very dressed up. Now, my mom drank in some very, very rough bars. I mean, these were violent bars where someone was regularly killed. It was just a routine thing. We didn't even get excited about it. And she came home this particular night. She was very dressed up. And she said to me, she said, "Tonight I had a glass of brandy." And I said, "Really?" You know, I mean, I don't think my mom had ever had brandy. I don't know if I knew what brandy was. But I knew I must have known because I knew it was alcohol. Because I said to her, I said, "You know, Mom, I thought because you were going to AA, you didn't drink anything." And she said, "It was brandy." All right, what do I know? You know. So I went to school the next day. Now, at this time, because my mom was sober, we were living in an apartment, and she had a job, and the gas, the phone, and the lights were all on. This is something that could only occur during sobriety in my lifetime. Just want to make sure you know that. So I left to go to school the next morning, and I came back from school after school at like 3 o'clock. I walked in the apartment, and there were like six guys and my mom all passed out, and there were bottles and drugs everywhere in the house. And that night in my room, one of the guys broke in and he tried to attack me, and I yelled for help, but nobody woke up because they were all passed out. And I finally managed to escape and get out of the apartment. And I came back the next morning because I needed to get ready for school. And they were kind of coming too. So my mom introduced me to her new boyfriend, who she had met the day before, who had just gotten out of prison that day for killing his girlfriend. And that is how fast our life went from the gas, the lights, and an apartment, you know, right back to the violence and the insanity of alcoholism. So I know that this is a progressive disease, you know. And I know that I have that fatal disease. You know, and it just gets worse. It doesn't get better, you know. And I really believe what the literature, you know, tells us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mom, not because I asked for help, not because I wanted help, not because I admitted having a problem. She just brought me because she thought if she left me alone, I might get her evicted from another apartment. And I sat in that meeting that night, and I did not raise my hand because I was not an alcoholic, and even if I had been, I wouldn't have joined an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it. And the miracle of this program began for me that night. And again, a lot of you may not identify with what the miracle was for me, but it was mine. There was a guy in that meeting that I admired more than anybody else in the entire world, and I did not admire very many people. And I admired him for reasons which, again, you may not identify with. But, you know, if I had to tell you all I wanted out of life, the only one goal that I could have ever thought that I would have been able to put together, and like Trish was saying, it would be hindsight. You know, I don't think I was consciously really aware of it. But what it was for me was that if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came down to Alcoholics Anonymous, all I ever wanted is I wanted the ability to walk into a room full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens, you know. But that's what I was hoping for, you know. And this guy at the meeting that night was a drinking friend of my mom's. His name was Paul. He drank in those same rough bars that I'm telling you about. And he was at the meeting that night. He had ridden his motorcycle. He had a knife. He had it with him that night. He had just gotten out of jail. And Paul was the kind of a guy I had seen walk into those bars where my mother was. And if he had been drinking and he wanted to sit at your table, you gave him the table. You didn't try and explain to him, Paul, there's four empty tables over there. You didn't do that because you didn't know what Paul would do to get your table. You just gave him the table. And so I looked at this man who had achieved everything that I wanted out of life. The ability to clear rooms and tables in a very rough bar. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it made a huge impression on me. I just never thought anybody that strong would have to come to AA. I got drunk the next night, and then I came back to meetings and I talked to Paul in between the meetings. He was the only person I talked to. I explained to him, you know, that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I wasn't anything like my mother, who we all knew was she was alcoholic, you know, that I had places to go, people to see, things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I was quite obviously not alcoholic. I might have a little problem with drugs. I was not alcoholic. Now, I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholics. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing. And he said, and they've told me I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you mix it with chemicals. And I happen to believe if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to make up some story like a teacher might do in high school. He was just talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in his life. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in my life. And I thought a little bit about what he said, that I did not want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not want to believe it could be that bad, you know. And yet in that 2 week period of time, every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. By the time I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only person that I hated more than my mother was me. And I hated my mother for everything that had ever gone wrong in our lives, and I want to assure you a lot had gone wrong, you know. And I blamed her, and I used her, and I've used my victimhood for as long as I possibly could, even after I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at this point in time, you know, like I said, the only person I hated more than her was me. And I was filled with hatred toward everyone. My mother and I had a violent relationship. And my mother was sober at this time for a very short period of time. She was just getting sober. And she didn't believe she had to be subject to physical attack in her apartment in sobriety, and she asked me to leave, and I did. The rest of my family had not spoken to me in a couple of years. I didn't bother trying to go there or talk to them. I had been in a number of foster homes. I had been thrown out of all of them. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were in the LA area. There weren't very many, just a couple. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. There was a program back then. Who was I talking with somebody today about called Synanon? I tried to get into Synanon. My mom had been involved there, and they wouldn't take me either, and that was really bad because they were actually recruiting for membership, you know, so things were really starting to look bad. But I thought, you know, who really cares? Who cares about programs and family and any of that? None of that really matters. If you're a tough fraud, the only thing that counts is your gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, all five members of my own gang beat me up. And I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a black eye, I had a swollen lip, I had no shoes. Would not have worn shoes if I had had them, because tough broads don't. But I had no shoes, I had no place to live, I had no money, I had no family, I had no place to turn, and so I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see where it was really kind of simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? I mean, it was just, that was it. You know, there were no options. And because my mom had been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for so many years, even at that time, a lot of people knew who my mom was, and they knew who I was because of her. And they came over to me, not everyone, but a couple of different meetings, they came over to me and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. And they didn't want a little kid sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me if I came back that they would get together and throw me out. And as I talked about that today a little bit, I just thought AA didn't want me either. And that was okay with me, because I hadn't wanted me in a long, long time. And yet, I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous had a tradition, the third tradition, that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And no one can throw anybody out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as long as they have that desire. I didn't know about it then. I don't think those people knew about it then either, you know. But fortunately, there were some other people in Alcoholics Anonymous who kind of took me under their wing and took me to these meetings. And Before that, though, you know, when I heard that they didn't want me, I went ahead and I went over to a friend of my mother's house, and I went into her bathroom, which is the place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. And when I got in that bathroom, I found enough of the pills that I needed to take to kill myself, and I took enough of them to do it one more time. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that day. And by the time I got to that meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit. I laid in the meeting. I haven't been to a lot of meetings in Georgia, but I'm assuming you don't usually call on people to share who are laying in the meeting. They did call on me to share that day. I have no idea what I said. They knew that I needed to be in a hospital, and Paul, that same guy that I told you about that I admired so much, drove me to the hospital. And a doctor there gave me medicine to make me throw up and explained to me later that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And that if I had been there maybe 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably could not have brought me out of. And I really can't tell you why that overdose was any different than all the other overdoses that I inflicted upon myself. It just was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And that's how I personally define sobriety, you know. And I really want to thank Trish for sharing today, you know, about changing her sobriety date. You know, when I heard your tape, before we met, I had heard her CD, and I sent it to a couple of friends of mine. Because it is a hard thing to do with our ego, you know. But I really think that secrets like that are probably the most dangerous thing, you know. And not just that kind of secret. I think any kind of secrets in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sort of along the lines of what Trish was saying about having a sponsor, you know, what, you know, Debbie shared this morning about talking to her sponsor. I mean, when we do things or say things, you know, that maybe we shouldn't, you know, but we do, you know, because we're human. It's really important. I have never had a thought at all that I haven't shared with someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I truly believe it's had a lot to do with my being able to stay, you know. And some of my thoughts, I wouldn't share them up here, you know. But I make sure to share them with someone, you know, and it usually is a sponsor, but sometimes it's a close friend or a spiritual guide if I can't get in touch with my sponsor. I have no secrets at all, not a single one. It's just not good for me. And I was taught that in early sobriety, and I do really believe, you know, that that's an important thing. You know, I have been fortunate enough that since that time I got out of that hospital that day, I have not taken anything. You know, I was telling Lee that there's some people back home, and they're sort of giving kind of a talk that seems to sort of say that relapse is just a part of recovery. You know, it's just sort of what we all do. Well, it's not. I just want to let you know that. I have been sober since, you know, my first meeting. The woman I talked with about today, Sybil Corwin, who came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1941 after writing a letter to General Service Office, she never drank again. My sponsors both have never drank again. You know, and not only that, but I have to say, at least with respect to those people, and I know many others, but I'll only give you those, you know, that none of us have been plagued with a strong desire or compulsion to drink since we came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have been given the gift, you know. And I'll tell you, a good friend of mine, Kay, you know, she was talking not too long ago, and Kay was saying, you know, getting sober when you're an alcoholic is such a gift. And if you're here tonight and you're sober, you've got the gift. I'm not saying everything in your life feels wonderful. I promise you that my life has not always either. You know, and neither has anybody else that I know, you know, in the years that I have walked this journey. But the thing is this, is that, you know, it's sort of like a seal who's trying to break through the ice. If you're sober and you're an alcoholic, you have broken through the ice. And if you go back to drinking, we just don't know when the next break is going to come or if you're going to get to make it through that break in the ice, you know. I really do believe I have been given a gift. But I have had to do a lot of work, and so have the people that I have known, you know. And it talks about that, you know, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Years ago, one of Sandy's closest friends, a guy named Ed Chandler, who has passed away, Ed gave a talk, and I've never forgotten his talk, and I'll go ahead and steal it now that I've given him credit for it. But what he did is he told a story about a family who got on a boat. They were immigrants. And they had saved up their money, and it was a man and his wife and their child, and they had saved up their money to go ahead and take that boat trip over to America, I think. We'll just make it that. And in doing that, they had just enough money for that ticket. That was it. They didn't have another dollar left. And they got on the boat, and as when they were on the boat, they saw lots of people, and they would go to these meals that were served three times a day, these incredible banquet meals, you know, that just had tons and tons of food of every kind, and dessert tables and salad tables and all of these, but they didn't have any more money. They'd used all their money, you know, for the ticket. And so they just sort of sat in their little corner, and they had brought some food, but they ran out of food on the journey. And as they were traveling, you know, this man's wife and child, I think it was a girl, but anyway, the man's wife and child were getting sicker and sicker and weaker and weaker, and he began to realize they weren't going to make the journey if they didn't get some food. And so this man swallowed his pride, and he went up to the captain of the ship, and he said, "Sir," he goes, I've got to beg you to help my wife and my child. They're not going to make it through this journey. You've got to please let us have some of this food that there's so much of. We don't have any money to pay for it. I'll make up for it when I get to this other country. I'll get a job. I promise I'll pay you back. But please, please let them have something to eat because we're not even going to survive to make the journey. And we've given every dime we had just to take this journey." And the captain said, "Well, sir, let me see the tickets that you have, please." And he took out his tickets for him and his family. And the captain looked at him and he said, "But sir," he said, "these tickets entitled you to every meal we have ever had on this ship." You know? And what Ed was talking about is that that's sort of what happens sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that we come in here and we get the meetings and we get the fellowship, and that is important. It is critical. It has done so much for me. But there's so much more, you know, and that's why it's really great if you can find yourself a spiritual guide who can lead you through the principles, you know, of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so that you're not just looking at all the beautiful food and all the beautiful stuff that's going on, but you're actually getting it. Because, you know, it's yours, and it's right here, and there are lots of people that will be willing to show you. And I have been blessed beyond anything I could ever possibly even begin to tell you about with the amount of people who have touched my life and have, have shown me through their spiritual guidance, you know. And I have, as I said earlier today, but I want to make it very, very clear, I have made lots and lots of mistakes. I have failed at lots and lots of things in the years that I have been sober. But what I want to let you know is that you do not have to drink to start over. And I'm just saying that because I tell you, this past summer, you know, Lee and I were sharing conversations. I've got the privilege of going to hear Lee in Connecticut. But I went to 14 meetings back east while I was back there with one of my kids this summer. And I did not, I attended a meeting, all these meetings, I went to these 14 meetings, or maybe more, in that 2 weeks, and every single person talked about relapse and how many times they had relapsed. Every single person, so much so, I was beginning to think, am I just imagining this? And a woman raised her hand at one of the meetings the second week that I was there. I'd been to that group the week before. I was back there. It was a step study. She raised her hand and she said, "I have 60 days sober." And she says, "It sounds like everybody drinks again. Am I going to have to drink?" You know? And so I want to make sure when I get an opportunity now to share at a meeting to let you know that you don't. You don't have to drink to start over, you know? And that there are people that will help you, and that this book tells us there is a solution, you know? I want to read you from the foreword to the 12 and 12. It's one of my favorite, you know, lines. And I'll tell you a little bit about why in just a minute. People, lots of other people read it. I'm sure you probably, a lot of you have heard it. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's one of my favorite lines, primarily because it says happily, you know. It's like we're not just getting by. Some days we are. Some months we are. Maybe even some years sometimes it feels like, you know. But this is an amazing journey. And there is a lot of joy and a lot of adventure. You know, I was reading a book. Well, you know, we were talking about somebody. I can't even keep everything straight. But I was reading Chuck C's book not that long ago, A New Pair of Glasses. And he was saying in there something that helped me so much. It was right around the time that I ran into Diz that, you know, 3 years ago when I was having a hard time and I was, you know, 34 years sober, you know, having a hard time, you know. And anyway, and I was reading it and he said, "There is always as much ahead as there has been behind." You know, what an amazing thing, you know. All right, well, now I'm going to jump around a little bit, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my sobriety, and then I'm going to jump around some more, because that's just kind of what I do. When I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, excuse me, as I mentioned, I hated myself. I hated pretty much everybody. I just hated some people more, but no one did I hate as much as me. I never stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous then or during any hard time because I was afraid of going back out on the streets and dying. I want to let you know I tried to die as long and as hard as I could out there, and I didn't make it. So what kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous was the idea that I might be able to go back out there and live the way that I was living. And by the time I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not have gone on breathing in and out two more times hating myself any more than I did. So I was really stuck. I was at the jumping off place, as it talks about. I couldn't drink and it wasn't working, and I didn't know what I was going to do to stay sober. Because to stay sober meant that, like, you know, that I was going to become in touch with my feelings. And I didn't like that, you know. And now I was sober and quite aware of who I was and where I had been and what I had done. And it just did not feel good at all. And it sounded to me like everybody else took a 30-day chip and got their self-respect back, you know, and could look people in the eye and went out there. That's how it sounded to me. I know today that that wasn't really necessarily true for everybody. I am a person, you know, I judged my mother very, very harshly, as I've already mentioned, before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and in the early years of my sobriety. But later on, you know, through the process of this program, I began to just have a totally different, you know, reaction to my mother and her alcoholism. My mother's alcoholism was a disease that caused her to violate her morals and her principles. And it was extremely painful for her. You know, the disease of alcoholism really affected her moral fiber. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't believe I ever had any moral fiber. And what that means is that I didn't care what I did. And I didn't care what you did. Because I didn't care about me at all. I hated so much everything about myself that there wasn't anything worse that could happen as far as I was concerned. And so I put myself in positions that no one with self-respect would ever have put themselves in. And so for me, I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous and regain my self-respect. I had to learn it here, you know. And it was a slow, slow process. And, you know, I'm going to read you this part in the book. Let's see. Here it is. Okay. This is from 132 and 133, because I won't remember these page numbers later. I'll tell you that. But I have them marked, because people come up and they ask me. I'm like, I don't know. You know, I hardly can. All right. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Here we go. Okay. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid, then, the deliberate manufacture of misery. I thought, what a wonderful thought. You know, I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still was able to manufacture quite a bit of misery, even in sobriety, you know. But again, I didn't drink, and I went to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed active, you know. I came into this program, as I said, I hated everybody. I hated women the most of all. I never wanted to be a woman. I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't like my mother. I didn't like me. I didn't want to sit next to women. I didn't want to shake hands with women. I most assuredly did not hug women, and I did not like listening to women speakers, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like, you know. The men in Alcoholics Anonymous, they scared me. I knew they said they were alcoholic. The only men I'd ever known were pretty much alcoholic. They were all extremely violent. I figured you guys were alcoholic. You were men. You were probably violent. I didn't want anything to do with you either. And I had a problem because all we had in Alcoholics Anonymous were men and women. I didn't like any of them. But I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to 22 meetings a week most of the first couple years that I was sober. I had a commitment at almost every one of those meetings, not because I wanted to get a gold star in AA, because I really was afraid this might not work for me. I was very, very damaged when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, mentally and physically. It was bad. You know, when people didn't know me and they would guess my age, they were guessing my age at 37 years old when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 13. Now, I stand up here tonight, and if I continue to do what I have been doing one day at a time, the 13th of July of this year, I will celebrate 37 continuous years of sobriety. So, just mathematically, you can see that I am older now than they were guessing me to be back then. And I got to tell you, I feel 1,000 years younger than I did when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so old when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had so many wonderful, inspiring, fantastic speakers and members of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was not one of them, or all of them put together, that could have convinced me that someday I would not feel old. That someday that feeling would be gone. I wouldn't have believed it. I just thought life was so over, and there was nothing left but to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I listened to these people share, and I talked about this earlier today, you know, for me, the speaker meetings were absolutely critical. The stories that people shared absolutely touched my heart in a way that nothing else could have. I could not let people get near me in any way, not physically, certainly. And so those stories and the people that shared, they touched my heart, and I felt the hope. I believe that these people had gotten to a point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and that somehow, through staying sober and working these principles in their lives, that they had gotten to a point where they could walk on the sunny side of the street, where they could feel like one of God's kids, no better than anybody else, no less than anybody else, just like one of God's kids. And I believed those people. I just knew they were telling me the truth. I did not believe that that could happen for me. But what I did believe, because there was so much hope, is that maybe if I went to lots and lots of these meetings and I had lots and lots of commitments and I tried these principles as best as I could, that maybe one day I'd be walking down a street and I'd happen to glance in one of those storefront mirrors, which was the closest thing to looking in a mirror I ever planned to do, ever. Maybe I wouldn't feel like throwing up at what I saw looking back. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had finished the seventh grade, or I had dropped out in seventh grade. I don't even know. I mean, who cares? You know, I mean, I went to, you know, 18 grammar schools. I think I went to 7 junior highs. I went to 6 high schools. I finished seventh grade. I mean, it was just, you know, I never went a whole semester anywhere in my life. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor really wanted me to return to school. And I did try, and it was just a terrible failure. I did not fit in, as you can imagine. I had a bad attitude. I didn't wear shoes. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I hated everybody, including myself. So I really wasn't welcomed in there. And, you know, and I had a series of, problems going on. You know, I had the privilege of many times being sent to Chuck C. In the early years of my sobriety, because that's where they would send you if you were really in bad shape. They go, you got to go see Chuck, you know. And they would send me to see Chuck C. And, you know, we joke about this now because I wasn't really as excited about it as some people think, you know, you would be, you know, because Chuck could talk for hours, you know, and I didn't have a car. So someone would drive me there and Chuck would talk for like 4 hours, you know. And I don't know if you've ever had these conversations with your sponsors, but they don't really get to the point. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you try and tell them a real practical situation, and they're just spouting off about all kinds of stuff that really is not going to help. You know, it would be as if you walked up to someone and you said, excuse me, what time is it? And they said, it's a horse. You know, it's like, we're really not communicating, you know. So, you know, at one point when I was facing all these different court cases and I was facing deportation, because one of the times when my mom got drunk, she turned me into the immigration authorities. So I was facing deportation in early sobriety. And then I had this other court case going, and the judge ordered me to leave the state of California sober under sworn testimony that I had left. You know, this is one of those times where they sent me to see Chuck C., you know. And Chuck just thought that was hysterical. You know, he'd introduce me. He'd say, this is my friend June. She's wanted in 2 states and not wanted in the other 48. Now, I had no sense of humor. I mean, that is not funny, you know. And he'd say, we don't worry about our related disorders. We just take care of our number one problem. I'm thinking, no, not the immigration. I mean, that's just not like a little related, you know, help me here, you know.
It's like, oh, just go to a meeting. You know.
Anyway, the amazing thing is, though, is that over the years, there is probably no one whose little sayings come through my daily life more often than the things that Chuck was to share. You know, like, we don't think our way into right living. We live our way into right thinking. And what an amazing thing, you know, that has proven to be for me, you know. And his idea of, you know, of doing things for fun and for free, which was, what a concept. That just made no sense. I mean, I was such a taker. I was such a thief when I came down to Toxonomist. And I just think, he does not live in the real world. And he really didn't seem to either. I mean, if you knew him, you'd know he didn't. He lived in Laguna Beach, you know, had this beautiful home looking out at the ocean. I mean, that's a little different than the alleys in Venice, you know, where I was, like, not sleeping indoors. You know, I mean, and he's like, oh, you know, we don't need to steal. We have everything. Well, no, let's hope not. You know, I mean, it's, you know, and that's kind of what he would tell me. He's like, you already have everything you're ever going to need. I go, no, no, wait, let's, you know, let's go over that again. I really don't, you know. But he felt sure that I did. And I'll tell you, as I look back on it, I did. We all do, you know. But it's a really hard, you can't hear until you can hear. That was the other thing he would say. And when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, you know. I thought today, too, I wanted to tell real quick a story about Bob Corwin, which was Sybil's husband. Because Bob made one of the most important contributions to me in my life. Because Bob had gotten sober. He actually just died last year, and that was who the birthday party was that I was giving. And unfortunately, he was too sick. He wasn't able to come that day, but he was one of the people I was giving the party. He had 58 years, and he was one of the people that was going to be coming. But Bob told a story where he was in a meeting, and they were reading Chapter 5, and he'd already been sober a long time, and he'd already heard Chapter 5 more times than anybody would want to. So he didn't really need to listen because he'd already heard it. Except for this woman who was reading it, she began to cry right near the end. And, you know, when someone begins to cry and they're reading something in a meeting, he was sharing about how we kind of all root for him. We're kind of trying to, you're going to make it, just come on. You know, so he's really paying attention, like that would help, you know, get through. And she began to read the ABCs. And all of a sudden she read, and see, God could and would if he were sought. And Bob talked about how he had always thought that that said God could and would if he were found. And that night he realized it said God could and would if he were sought. And what Bob shared about was that maybe the closest he would ever get would be in the seeking. And that has helped me more than any single line I can think of right now in my spiritual journey, because I am not a person who's had an easy spiritual journey. It has definitely been what it talks about in the book, the slow and educational variety. There have been times where, like Bill Wilson, many times, I have been seized with a rebellion where I cannot pray, where I don't want to pray, where I don't want anything to do with any of that stuff. And yet, if I pray to become willing to seek, somehow it seems to get softened and things seem to open up and change, you know, for me. Anyway, all right, let's see. I'm going to jump back here. When I came to this program, I had a very limited vocabulary. It was almost all profanity. You know, there were a few exceptions that I mentioned earlier today, the and mother. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I got sober. I lit all of them myself. Occasionally someone would hold a match, and I let them hold it as long as they liked. They never lit my cigarette with it. After I'd been sober a short period of time, I took up smoking cigars and then later a pipe. I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankle. I did not wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. And on the back of my jacket, it said, do unto others and then split, which was my own spiritual philosophy. And I didn't plan on changing it just because you guys had yours. You know, this was mine. It seemed to be working, I thought. But I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got very active in a great group that taught me about service and the traditions, you know, and working with others. And eventually, you know, what Chuck C. talked about, you know, not too long ago, I was listening to one of his talks, and he said that he didn't think very many people ever come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get sober or get grabbed by the idea of the spiritual principles. He said it's the spirit that grabs us first. And that was what happened for me. I was absolutely grabbed by the spirit of these people in Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew they were talking, they knew where I had been, you know. And Anyway, you know, and so I got very active. I stayed very active. I have remained active in Alcoholics Anonymous in a variety of different ways. There's so many different service opportunities in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have not been one of those people that have felt bored in the years that I've been sober, because I've just tried so many different things, and it's just been a fascinating kind of an experience. That doesn't mean, by the way, that I like everyone in AA. You know, I mean, I heard someone say once, if you like everyone in AA, you might not be going to enough meetings. So, I mean, I don't want to have you think that. It has not always been, you know, a big pink cloud where I just love everybody in AA. That hasn't been true. But I have always stayed close to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have always kept my commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I wanted to or not, whether I thought I should or not. You know, it didn't matter. I showed up, and that has served me very, very well. After I had been sober for a while, I got an opportunity to, my sponsor arranged an opportunity for me to go to a business college and learn how to be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it would be a secretary. You know, it's not something that tough broads kind of want to do. She arranged this for me. I started out at the school. I typed 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I went to school one day at a time. At the end of that time, I was typing like 37 words a minute with 19 errors. You know, they told me I wasn't going to make it as a secretary, which I've kind of always known. But they said maybe I could get some kind of another office job, and I went out there, and now I had to go look for a job. And I was about 2.5, 3 years sober. This was the hardest thing that I had to do in my sobriety. It was the first time I had to go out into the world. I was just hiding in those 22 meetings a week, and that was barely, I could barely do that. And now I had to go out into the world, what I call the citizen-y type world, you know, and deal with them, you know. And some people on the program, you know, they took me out, some women, and they bought me some clothes. You know, we went to the Salvation Army, or they gave me some clothes, and we dressed me up. I felt like, you know, look at the little Venice Bride in the citizen costume, you know. And I went out there, and, you know, I started interviewing for these jobs, and eventually I got a job, and it was so square. I knew my sponsors would love it. I got a job in an insurance company, you know, and I went to work, and on the 7th day they called me in. I thought maybe they'd want to give me a raise. And they said, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You don't have, you know, enough experience, and you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever. Now, I didn't know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I had been going to meetings, a lot of meetings. I was 2.5 years sober, a lot of meetings. I had never heard of anyone sober being fired. And so I went downstairs and I called the LA Central office and I reported that company, because I didn't think we'd allow things like that to happen. I thought we'd pick it, you know, or something. And they kind of laughed like you guys did and sent somebody over to pick me up. And I can remember talking to my sponsor that night, and I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job, which is why sponsors are great at just taking that. They just catch that little stuff that, oh, yeah, okay. So anyway, so now I had to go out and look for another job, you know, and I ended up getting a job in a bank. Now, I'd never even been in a bank in my life, and I had been a thief longer. I'd been stealing longer than I'd been drinking. So, I mean, you know, just the idea of being in this bank. And they hired me. Not only did they hire me to work in this bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if AA worked that good. You know, I mean, I thought, are you guys, you've got to be kidding, you know. And I did not steal anything the entire time I worked there. I'm not going to tell you I didn't think of stealing something, because that wouldn't be true. But I did not steal anything while I worked there. And while I was there, I decided, you know, after I'd been there for a while, I wanted to take a class at night. They called it a dummy English class over at the City College. But I wanted to learn how to read again, because I had lost that ability. I could read. I could read you the words on a page. But it didn't go anywhere for me. I couldn't remember that from the beginning of sentence to the end of sentence what the sentence said and what it meant. You know, that's how damaged my brain was. And so I took this class hoping that maybe it would help. And then I took a couple of other classes, and I ended up getting laid off from that job. And so I got a job at the school, and I worked in the cafeteria, and then I cleaned apartments on the weekends, and then I worked in the library, and I had like 5 different little jobs so that I could go to school. And I started to go to college full time. It was a city college. I'd never gone to high school, and I got a GED, and I went ahead and I took these classes, and after about 3 years, I think, they called me and they told me I'd completed all the requirements for what they called an AA degree. I thought that was a nice name for a degree, and I went on and I graduated from that college. And both of my sponsors and some of my friends and some of my family were at that graduation, because we began to kind of repair that damage in my family relationship. I was over 5 years sober before I got a Christmas card. You know, it was a very slow process here for me. 10 years, I think, before keys to anything were allowed near me. But anyway, I went ahead and I applied to go on to a university because my sponsors told me that's what I had to do if I wanted to have dreams come true here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to do the same footwork anybody in or out of AA had to do. And so I went ahead and I applied for these universities. I was accepted at a university. I went on and I completed the university a couple of years later, and I continued to work and put myself through school. And then I had another dream, and I don't know where it came from, but I went ahead and did the footwork as I was taught by my sponsors, and I got a telegram, and gosh, now it's been over 20 years ago, telling me that I had been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. And I went to law school, and you know, there's absolutely no way I can really tell you about, you know, my life's adventures in this program. So I'm going to kind of skip around a little bit. I did go to law school. Today I have a job. I have a job where I am reminded I have never had a day when I am in court, and I'm in court every day that I go to work. I have never had a day where I am not reminded of where the disease of alcoholism takes people like me. You know, in the years that I've been sober, when I have run into the women that I grew up with, there isn't a single one of those women that I know of that isn't dead, locked up in an institution, or out on the streets turning tricks so that they can support the habit that they have. They all live in a place where the gas, the phone, and the lights are never all on at the same time. God doesn't like me any better than those women. I'm not any prettier than any of those women, and I'm certainly not any smarter than any of those women. You know, one thing that's different between them and me is that I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was given a gift. You know, I still have that very same disease, and it has gotten worse during the years that I have been sober. And so it is important that I remain vigilant in trying to practice these principles, you know, and keep the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people close in my life. I'm going to jump ahead now, and I'm not going to throw in everything because it's just not possible. But I want to go ahead and I'm going to talk a little bit about the last 3 years and some of the things that have gone on. Let's see how I'm going to do that, because I want to bring in Sybil real quick in there. 3 years ago, I have three daughters. I know you guys have kind of heard me mention that, and they're three teenage daughters. And believe me, you know, if you, those of you who have lived with teenagers, you know, especially, you know, even in sobriety, that there are some days where, you know, I'm looking at these kids and I'm thinking, you know, if they were newcomers, I would say, you need to work with somebody else. Yeah. But you just don't get to do that as a parent. But I mean, like, are you kidding me here? You know. And 3 years ago, I came out of a long marriage. And it was not a happy marriage. It was one where I believed in my mind. I had somehow come up with and one of the women I sponsored was, you know, had told me a couple of years before I ever came out of this marriage, she said, you know, I think you have a really old idea, you know, but my idea was you stay married no matter what. You don't drink and you stay married. And I think it was almost, as I've looked at it over the years, it was almost like a game of chicken. You know, I'm Irish, I'm stubborn, and I'm not quitting, you know. And you know, and that isn't really. I'm hoping that's not what marriage is really supposed to be about. You know, but that's kind of where I think I went with that. I just didn't think there was any other option, and I prayed a lot. I tried to work the spiritual principles of, in every way that I possibly could, and it was just not going to work. And I felt when I came out of that marriage that I had a giant F on my report card, you know, or on my life. And I think that part of it was, you know, I just don't give up. And I really thought that that was part of my journey, you know. And I don't believe that anymore. It's sort of like when Sandy talks about, you know, what else was I wrong about? Well, okay, so that was one thing. But anyway, that happened in June, and I met Diz and saw these guys in July. And I'll tell you, when I went to talk at that conference in Florida in July, of that year, I didn't want to go. This was 3 or 4 weeks after I had just, you know, this had just ended, and I was just still very confused, and I certainly was not capable or willing of talking about this. And Sandy told me I didn't have to, you know, when we talked, but we actually really connected there because Sandy knew I was in a lot of pain. And the reason I went to that conference really was because I'd been taught that you always show up. Even if you don't want to, and even if you don't feel like you have anything to say, and even if you don't feel like you have a lot of hope, and even if you don't feel like you've done it right, And even if you feel like you're getting an F on your report card, you show up. And I showed up largely because Sandy and Bob B. from Minnesota were going to be there, and they were going to be sharing. And those two men, I had heard them talk in the years that I had been sober about tough times in their sobriety. And they had shown up. And they had helped me ever so much during all the years that I'd been sober, you know, and that they kept showing up, that they kept staying sober as they walked through their pain. And so because of that, I showed up. And at that time, I connected with Sandy, and he became one of the most important spiritual guides I've ever had. He's been a very important part of my life these last 3 years. And at the same time, I connected with another guy, Bob Regan, back home, who's got 42 years. And as I mentioned this afternoon, these are two men they had over 40 years at the time, incredibly enthusiastic members of Alcoholics Anonymous, incredibly active members of Alcoholics Anonymous on every level that you could possibly imagine, you know. And I felt at that time, I never wanted to drink, you know. I mean, that wasn't something that came up for me. What I felt was that I had been given more miracles than anybody I knew. Just absolutely, just flat out, I had been overpaid already, way past overpaid. And so my feeling was that all the good times had already happened because I'd already had all the miracles anybody should ever get. And, you know, that was just the way that it was. And God was sort of out of miracles for me. We were just done, and I had to be, you know, I needed to be grateful, and I really was grateful. I really felt okay. Now, Bob and Sandy were convinced that there was as much ahead, just like Chuck was saying, you know, as there was behind. And I wasn't quite as willing to believe that. I can remember sitting there, and Bob said, "You will not believe where your life is going to be a couple of years from now." And I said, "You know, Bob, I've used that line on new people." And I've seen it happen, and I've experienced it. I have experienced it time and again. But this time, I don't believe a word you're saying. And he goes, "That's all right. You don't have to. You're just going to keep showing up." Anyway, for my 35-year AA birthday, I went to Hawaii, which is my favorite place in the entire world. It's a town called Kona. I went over to Kona, and I took my three daughters. And I love to swim with dolphins, and I'm rather new age in a lot of different ways. I don't want to scare you, but it's just sort of my deal. I have a lot of little things. I won't go into them too much, but it's my own little spirituality that happens. And so, for me, Kona and dolphins and the ocean have always been a huge deal for me. And so I went over there, and I love the AA over there. And I went to a meeting over there, and when I took my cake, my 35-year cake in Kona, I talked about Sybil. Now, I could easily that night, as I took my 35-year cake, I could have talked about at least 1,000 different people and told a story of how someone had made an important contribution in my life. But for some reason that night, I talked about Sybil. And I talked about what she said at that meeting that I attended when I was 30 days sober. She stood up there with 32 years, and she said, "Newcomers," she said, "I have had the most amazing journey here, the most amazing life." And she said, "And do you know, if I could wave a magic wand and give you the life that I have today," she said, "I wouldn't do it." Now, I was sitting there with 30 days, and I thought, I knew there weren't magic wands. I mean, I'm from the streets, you know. But I'm like, you know, that's mean. I mean, she should want to. She should say, "I wish I could." But she said, "I wouldn't even do it if I could. I don't want to." And I'm thinking, that's just mean. And she said, "I wouldn't do it because I wouldn't want to rob you of your journey." And as I took my cake that night, I said, "You know, here's the deal. I am so grateful that Sybil didn't and couldn't rob me of my journey. Because I'll tell you right now, I never would have believed this, but it has been true for many more years than I can possibly tell you. I wouldn't trade places with anybody, even with the bumps in my road, even with the two sponsors that I have lost to cancer, even with the many painful experiences that I have experienced. You know, I've been a victim of a violent crime. I've had all kinds of different things happen in my life. I wouldn't trade places with anyone, and I happen to believe every single one of those things happened and needed to happen for me to be exactly where I am right now, and I don't want to be anywhere else but exactly where I am right now. And that's an amazing thing for me because I always wanted to look like you, feel like you, have your mother be from your town, have everything be different. And I didn't want to trade places with anybody, and it had been that way for a long, long time. Afterwards, this guy came up to me at the meeting, and he said, "I heard Sybil talk once when I was over on the mainland." And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, that's not that uncommon." And he said, "And you know what she said that night that meant the most to me was she read a letter from Bill Wilson." I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "I have that letter. Would you like a copy of it?" And I said, "Yeah, I sure would." And he goes, "Okay, I'll bring it to the meeting the next morning." And he did. And I have that letter, and I want to read it to you. But what I want to tell you is, real quick, I want to fill you in on a couple of things that were happening to Sybil, which I found out later through another series of coincidences that had happened, which was that this letter is in 1952. Sybil got sober in 1941. She was married, and she came home one night from a meeting, and her husband, who was not in AA, met her at the door, and he said, "Sybil, I know what we need to do to have our marriage work." And she said, "Great, what do we need to do?" And he said, "You need to drink." And he poured her a glass of wine. He said, "I don't like you going to all these meetings. I like you better when you're drinking." And she went upstairs and she packed her bag, and she had just the money that she had in her purse, and she walked out. Her and her brother Tex, who was her closest friend in the world and was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a business. It was kind of a boxing ring, I think is what it was, and it was a big deal. But in 1951, television began, and people stopped coming out, and they started staying home and watching television, and she lost her business. Her and Tex lost their business, and they had to file bankruptcy. And then Tex got sick with cancer, and this was Sybil's best friend, and he died. And there were a few other things that happened. I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but let me just, you know, make it clear that Sybil was having a bad day. You know, there were some bad things going on. And she wrote a letter to Bill Wilson. And this is the letter that Bill Wilson wrote back. It's dated November 6, 1952. "My dear Sybil, thanks for your letter of October 21st. It was just about the most stirring thing I have read in many a day. The real test of our way of life is how it works when the chips are down. Though I've often seen AAs make rather a mess of living, I've never seen a sober one make a bad job of dying. But the account you give me of Tex's last days is something I shall treasure always. I hope I can do half as well when my turn comes. I am one who believes that in my Father's house there are many mansions. If that were not so, there couldn't be any justice. I can almost see Tex sitting on the front porch of one right now, talking in the sunlight with others of God's ladies and gentlemen who have gone on before. I certainly agree with you that little was left in Tex's grave. All he had was left behind in the hearts of the rest of us, and he carried just that same amount forward to where he is now. If you like what I've said, please read it to the Huntington Park group. In any case, congratulate them for me that they had the privilege of knowing a guy like Tex. As for you, my dear, there is no need to give you advice. How well you understand that the demonstration is the thing after all. It isn't so much a question of whether we have a good time or a bad time. The only thing that will be asked is what we do with the experience we have. That you are doing well with your tough lot is something for which I and many others are bound to be grateful. This is but a long day in school. Some of the lessons are hard and others are easy. I know you will keep on learning and passing what you learned. What more does one person need to know about another? Affectionately yours, Bill." Now, you know, as I mentioned, you know, a couple of years ago, and even when I was talking with my sponsor, and I just really didn't believe at that moment that there was as much ahead. I mean, I just want to tell you, my life is just absolutely unbelievable. You know, yesterday my daughter got a letter that she'd been accepted to a couple of colleges. I am going to my first high school graduation in June if she keeps going to school for her, you know. And I have another daughter in a couple of weeks I'm going to be taking to look at colleges. They're only a year apart. I had Irish twins, you know. And I have found a new passion. I am surfing, and it is, like, unbelievable. It is the best. And sometimes I regret the past because I didn't start surfing before. But I am trying to stay, you know, in the moment. You know, I'm dating the most amazing guy. I'm having so much fun. I mean, my life is just on fire. And it talks about that, you know, in here. You know, that your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. You know, that we will become happy and useful and whole. And it's amazing, you know. So please, if you're in one of those long, dark hallways, and I have been in them many times through the years, please don't give up before your miracles happen. I have no idea what they're going to be. I don't know what mine are, but I'm hoping there's even more ahead. And what I want to tell you is, when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most amazing people I ever heard speak with, for me, was a guy named Norm Alpie, and Lee has some of his tapes. And every time I ever heard Norm Alpie talk, I wanted to join AA, and then I'd remember I already belonged, or I wouldn't have been there hearing him, you know. But Norm would always finish his talk, and he would say, "But for the grace of God, rooms like this, people like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks for not letting me."